We saw a record high turnout among Asian American voters in 2018 for a midterm election, and we are likely to see that again in 2020 for a presidential election.
An expert says that can be partially attributed to the new Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's Friday, August 14th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, one White House official says Chinese hackers were targeting U.S. election infrastructure. One who investigates the coronavirus says most people who have or had the disease have been uncounted. It is all on today's VOA Asia. Kamala Harris has become not only the first black woman on a major party's presidential ticket in the United States, she also became the first Indian American, South Asian, and Asian American person to be chosen. We welcome to VOA Asia Karthik Ramakrishnan, a professor of political science at the University of California, Riverside, and the director of the National Asian American Survey. Professor, thanks for being with us. What was your initial reaction to Joe Biden's choice of Senator Harris as his running mate?
You know, it's interesting because in some ways people characterize it as a safe choice, but in many ways it is historic and groundbreaking, right? So it's the first black woman nominated for vice president, the first Indian American, Asian American, South Asian American, however you want to characterize it, nominated for vice president.
How large is the Indian American community?
The Indian American population, there are two different ways that they measure it in the United States. One is if you look at people who just check off Indian, and those who say they're Indian and something else. So Kamala Harris would be someone who would fit that category. So if you look at the just Indian alone, it's about 4.2 million in 2018. That's the latest data that we have. And if you look at the combination, it's 4.5 million. To put that into context, that's about as large as the Chinese American population, which is the largest Asian American group, and has grown tremendously. So since 2000, the Indian American population has grown by 150%. So that is remarkable growth. It has more than doubled within 2 decades.
How much support does President Trump hold in the Indian American community? I was in Houston the day before Trump and the Indian prime minister drew tens of thousands of people to Reliance Stadium for a rally.
President Trump certainly has tried to make inroads in the Indian American community. He has a very close relationship with Prime Minister Modi. But at the same time, it was always going to be a bit of a challenge. Indian Americans traditionally, since we've been collecting data in 2008, have been very strong Democratic voters, and that doesn't change easily. On top of that, there have been many policies ranging from immigration to healthcare, and even the rhetoric of the president on issues related to race that has turned off a lot of Indian American voters. So it was going to be challenging to begin with. I think with Harris's appointment, that challenge became even steeper. And especially in states like Texas, Florida, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Michigan, these are all states with significant Indian American voters that could tip the balance towards the Democratic candidate.
It does appear that U.S. foreign policy is heavily swung toward India under Trump. Could that bring more Indian American votes to Donald Trump in November?
Yes. So, you know, what's interesting is that I think there's a lot more attention to this in India and also among more recently arrived immigrants or those who pay a lot of attention to U.S. foreign policy. Our surveys have shown throughout the years that U.S. foreign policy plays a very small role in the decision making of Indian American voters. I think if you look at a diverse country like America, you absolutely are going to have diversity of opinion in terms of particular issues, especially those involving foreign relations. My sense is that that Joe Biden and his team are responding to some of that criticism. And I've heard that there's going to be an event involving the Indian American community on Indian Independence Day, August 15th, that I think addresses some of those issues and concerns.
You do seem to be saying there's a greater Indian American voter support for the Democrats than for the incumbent Donald Trump. Why do you say that?
You know, I think it's important for listeners, especially in Asia, to understand that even though the vast majority of Asian American voters are naturalized citizens, meaning they're first generation immigrants, and even though they might retain their ties to the homeland, most of the issues that concern them are domestic issues. And those issues have tended to be the economy and jobs, and that's a major issue this year. The pandemic is likely going to be a major issue among Asian American voters. We're in the field with a survey right now. But then healthcare and education, these are also important issues. And on all of those issues, Democrats have tended to have an advantage. But we will see. It'll be an exciting time in 2020 because we saw record high turnout among Asian American voters in 2018 for a midterm election. And we are likely to see that again in 2020 for a presidential election.
Karthik Ramakrishnan, a professor of political science at the University of California, Riverside, and the director of the National Asian American Survey. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. Experts warn that a snap decision by the Malaysian government to limit migrant workers to just a few industries could backfire. Thailand's king swears in 6 new cabinet officials amid unprecedented student-led protests denouncing the monarchy. China pushes for the adoption of a new worldwide internet protocol that could make the internet bigger and faster, but also potentially less anonymous. 3 people in southern India are dead after violence erupted between police and protesters over a Facebook post about the Prophet Muhammad. An Afghanistan official says formal peace negotiations with the Taliban will begin in Qatar early next week. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. The selection of California Senator Kamala Harris as vice presidential running mate to presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden is both a history-making and politically safe choice, say analysts. As the first African-American and South Asian woman on a major party ticket, Harris brings unprecedented diversity to the contest. VOA's Brian Padden reports the senator and former state attorney general also bring ample experience in elected office, meeting the 77-year-old Biden's criteria that she be ready to serve as president if the need arises.
Kamala Harris had long been seen as the frontrunner in presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden's vice presidential search.
This is a moment of real consequence for America.
The California senator met his criteria for a highly qualified woman. Biden also faced pressure from within his party to choose an African American at a time when much of the country is focused on racial justice.
I think it's a great choice by Biden. Look, it's up to him right now to run a safe, smart campaign. Kamala Harris is a known entity. She's trusted. She's someone who has been vetted on the national stage, and she's a smart pick for it.
The selection of Harris, the daughter of Jamaican and Indian immigrants, should energize key Democratic constituencies.
I'm really happy that it's her, and obviously as a Black woman, it's just remarkable to see, you know, myself sort of represented on a national ticket in my lifetime. So I'm really excited about it.
Harris boasts experience as California's former top prosecutor and in the Senate, where she gained prominence for her tough questioning of President Donald Trump's nominees, including Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh at his 2018 confirmation hearing. A dynamic speaker, the one-time rival of Biden for the nomination is expected to be a formidable opponent to Republican Vice President Mike Pence on the debate stage. President Trump called Harris mean and disrespectful for her grilling of Kavanaugh. Trump also called Harris nasty, amplifying reported criticism within Biden's own team over Harris's attack on Biden's record during a past debate, accusing him of opposing school busing to increase racial integration in the 1970s, a charge that Biden said was a mischaracterization. And the Trump campaign put out an early attack ad calling Harris a radical leftist.
The Trump campaign is not going to be shy. They have the money, they have the weaponry, they have the ammunition to take down such a choice.
It is unclear whether branding Harris a radical will resonate with voters. Some believe the attacks could backfire if seen as overly sexist.
I do think they need to be very careful because they will turn off those white suburban women voters who they so desperately need in order to win this election.
The choice of Harris, a relative political moderate in a party trending leftward, could solidify Biden's support among pro-business independents, but she may disappoint the most progressive elements of the party demanding radical government intervention in the economy. Harris is seen as a safe choice for a campaign that is already ahead in public opinion polls, challenging a president whose leadership is being put to the test by the pandemic and an economic crisis. Brian Patton, VOA News, Washington.
Happening now in Asia, a major election monitoring group in Myanmar says it's been barred from observing polls set for November, raising questions about the credibility of a vote seen as a crucial test of democratic reforms in the country. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien said this past weekend that Chinese hackers were targeting U.S. election infrastructure in the lead-up to the November 3rd presidential election, making a new claim about the level of Beijing's activity in the election. With the U.S. political conventions about to get underway, VOA Mandarin Service reporter Adriana Zhang spoke with Edward Perez, the Global Director of Technology Development at OSET Institute, a nonprofit election technology organization, on the possibility of cyber breaches and disinformation from China on the elections.
In 2020, I think that the United States should definitely be considering China as one of several nation-state actors that could potentially be wanting to interfere in our presidential election. Whether it's China, whether it's Russia, Iran, North Korea, there's no doubt that a lot of foreign countries are attempting to exert influence in terms of their global power, in terms of their policy, by trying to influence the U.S. presidential election. It was definitely a watershed in 2016 when the U.S. intelligence community found that that Russia was responsible for such meddling. And I think it is safe to assume that not only since 2016 are other countries going to stand down or do less, but if anything, we probably need to be even more prepared. And yes, I would include China again, along with several other countries. And I think it's important to maintain perspective. Many do believe that the most formidable threat is not China, but is Russia. But that is not a reason to protect ourselves on multiple fronts.
So which one do you think is more damaging to the U.S. election and the democracy? Is the hacking behavior or the disinformation?
I think that the damage that can be done by disinformation should not be underestimated. And the reason for that is, generally speaking, it is easier to wage a disinformation campaign and to create doubt, to undermine the credibility of the elections. It is easier to do that sort of a campaign with something as straightforward as social media, careful placement of false or partially false information with the media. There are so many ways to influence people's opinion through the media and through social media with disinformation that it's generally an easier kind of attack to wage than actually getting into very sensitive cybersecurity systems. I think that even within the U.S., the cybersecurity infrastructure security agency, for example, that works within the Department of Homeland Security, on the one hand, they express a great degree of confidence in the extra protection that they have been able to give cybersecurity systems, especially as compared to 2016. They do think that there's more attention, more awareness, and more resources available. Given all of that, I think it's especially telling when that same federal agency that is trying to protect elections has really been very consistent in their own concern about disinformation and the challenges that it faces. There is absolutely no doubt that it will be a very important factor in the November elections. It's already happening now. It's probably safe to assume that those efforts will be ramped up before then. And the United States, again, as a matter of national security, really be thinking about those sorts of threats, both domestic and from foreign actors.
VOA Mandarin Service reporter Adriana Zhang speaking with Edward Perez, Global Director of Technology Development at the OSET Institute.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. A teachers' federation in Indonesia says that country's move to reopen schools in some areas risk creating new clusters of coronavirus cases, with at least 180 students and teachers infected since a new academic year started in July. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. In late March, COVID-19 survivor Deanna Berendt found a grassroots movement called Survivor Corps with a two-part mission. First, it would mobilize COVID-19 survivors to donate their antibody-rich plasma to those who were infected. And second, Survivor Corps volunteers would participate in scientific research to better understand and develop treatments. 5 months and millions of infections later, doctors now deal with the debilitating long-term symptoms the novel coronavirus can cause in those who are no longer contagious. VOA's Adam Phillips asked Berendt for an update, both on the lessons learned and the gaps that remain.
We have learned so much since last we spoke. When we spoke last, we thought it was a respiratory disease. We now understand it's a clotting disease, which is why it's affecting the brain and the heart and the kidneys and all of the other organs. And we thought that it only affected the elderly and the immunocompromised, but we are all extremely vulnerable to this disease. There's nobody who is safe from it. And we now know it's airborne. That changes things dramatically.
What else have you learned?
That COVID is having a long-term impact on people's bodies and on children's bodies as well. However, the vast majority of people who are infected with COVID, and we are now at over 5 million infections in the United States, are being actively told to not seek any medical help whatsoever unless they cannot breathe, in which case they are to go to the emergency room. So the vast majority of people infected with COVID are not being tracked by the medical community. Their experiences have gone basically unrecorded, and they are suffering 5-6 months into the virus with debilitating symptoms. And we are also actually launching Recovery Corps, which will be a longitudinal study done in coordination with Columbia University. It will track COVID patients over years, tracking their antibody levels and tracking them symptomatically to see how their symptoms evolve and hopefully resolve over time. But unfortunately, we are going to need to have post-COVID care centers throughout the country.
Diana Berendt is the founder of Survivor Corps, connecting COVID-19 survivors with the medical, scientific, and research communities.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
Thank you for being with us on VOA Asia. Hong Kong's Commerce Secretary Thursday rejected U.S. plans to order goods imported from the territory to carry a Made in China marking from September. Speaking after meeting representatives of local trade chambers, Edward Yao said the rule was a deliberate attempt to sort of undermine Hong Kong's custom territory, which was separate from mainland China.
Our reaction to the U.S. Recent attempt to impose a origin marking requirement on Hong Kong product, basically sort of asking Hong Kong traders to tell a lie that, well, product made in Hong Kong would be misdescribed as made in China. It's a deliberate attempt to sort of undermine Hong Kong's separate custom territory, which is a very important pillar for Hong Kong as an international trading center, which is well recognized by all members of WTO. And I hope U.S. would not be the exception, because they are also a fellow member together with Hong Kong in WTO.
A Hong Kong government statement this week also strongly objected to the U.S. plans, which were published on the U.S. Federal Register by the Customs and Border Protection. Continuing travel restrictions and border closures have separated many unmarried couples, but the Love is Not Tourism movement is hoping to get couples back together. Karina Bafrazian has the story.
Since mid-March, thousands of unmarried international couples have become part of the Love is Not Tourism movement. They have signed petitions in the hope of convincing governments to allow them to see their loved ones again.
It started with Denmark, right? This started late to, actually, I believe they started organizing before May even, but it was the realization that Denmark's families and partners could gather together, create a hashtag, petition their government for a sweetheart law, and they were able to have that law announced in June 19th, 2020. In the United States, unfortunately, we have not received much of any response, nothing like in Europe.
Similar laws were implemented in other European countries, including Norway, the Netherlands, the Czech Republic, and Austria. In other parts of the world, the situation is more complicated. American Elizabeth Thorne and Colombian Mario have been dating for a few years, but because of the pandemic, they have not seen each other for over 6 months. Strict travel restrictions in Colombia don't allow them to meet even in the third country. In order to avoid these problems in the future, they have decided to get married.
Because we're not married, in this moment, we're trying to get a marital civil union, because it's the only thing that we can really do while we're separated. In the 21st century, how it's funny that, you know, like, people who are not married are not considered family. It's such an outdated kind of way to view family.
The lockdown and travel restrictions have created a lot of challenges for unmarried couples. In some cases, even unmarried couples with a child can't be together. But members of the Love is Not Tourism say they will follow the rules if they are allowed to be together.
And we want to follow the rules. We're more than willing to pay for our own coronavirus tests. We're quarantined. We're willing to wear masks. Even though in the United States we have seen a pushback against masks, that's not a problem for us. We're willing to social distance. We just need a solution in place.
Thanks to social distancing, even couples that live in the same town have become long-distance partners. But psychologists say it's possible to make it through.
You can make it through those times by holding strong, holding true, and saying, wait a second, even though I can't see them physically, right? Can't hug them, touch them, you know, cuddle with them, whatever I want, but I can be connected with them emotionally.
This is what American Susan Parker and her fiancé from the Netherlands, Egbert, been trying to do for the last few months. They talk to each other every day and dream about their future wedding. The couple met last winter and were planning to get married until COVID-19 interfered.
I didn't know what to do. And not too long ago, a neighbor of mine saw an article in, I think it was the New York Times, talking about this group, Love is Not Tourism. And I thought to myself, oh, that so perfectly describes the situation.
Susan and Egbert are among the lucky ones. On July 27th, the Netherlands allowed travel for foreigners that are in a relationship with Dutch citizens. So the couple may resume their wedding plans, finally in person. Karina Befredjian for VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter, at VOA Asia. You can find us on Instagram and YouTube as well, and at voanews.com. Thank you for being with us today. Thanks to our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, which includes Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Please stay safe and enjoy the day ahead.